Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the AMAA Martial Arts Masters Blog Talk Radio Show, hosted by the American Martial Arts Alliance, dedicated to building the awareness of professionalism in the martial arts through martial arts management and student development.
Everyone, this is Grandmaster Jesse Bowen. Danny, are you there?
Yes, sir. Danny McCall's here.
Oh, well, good. I was sitting right in the background for Professor Gary Lee. Looks like he dropped off the call. But hey, everyone, this is the American Martial Arts Alliance Blog Talk Radio Show, and with Professor Gary Lee, and I think he's just coming back on. Now, that's the one thing about technology. Technology always works until it doesn't work. But again, welcome everybody to the call tonight. And I think Professor Gary Lee, I think he just got back on the call. Are you there, sir?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you, Brother Jesse. Welcome to another installment of the AMAA Pioneers and Legends Show. Tonight we have an incredible show with one of the old-timers and pioneers of sport karate, a legend in the Southern karate circles. But before we get to him, I want to talk a little bit to my listeners and say thank you again for listening to us tonight and listening to us for the past few shows. They've been so successful, and we're looking forward to doing some really great shows in the future. So right off, to start things off, I'd like to let you know that we're a big supporter of the people that got hit by the hurricane, and we're supporting the United Way. Mr. Jesse Bowen with the American Martial Arts Alliance, he is going to donate from the show tonight. Anyone that buys a book, proceeds, some of the proceeds will actually go to some of the flood victims. So if you'd like to help out those people in North Carolina, which are martial artists and non-martial artists that were affected by the flood, please feel free to pick up one of these incredible books that Mr. Joe Corley, Mr. Jeff Smith, and Mr. Bowen put together for all of us to share with you the pioneers and legends of martial arts. I'd like to let you know we support the sportkaratemuseum.org. And for more information, you can go there directly at www.sportkaratemuseum.org. We're very excited about this week. We've actually put in three gentlemen that are over 80 years old as history generals. Mr. David J. Pram from Detroit, Mr. Joe Goss, and Nate Drouillard. And they were brought to us by one of the great history generals, Mr. A.J. Perry, which, by the way, some of our upcoming shows will feature A.J. Perry, Dana Abbott. We have Jamie Cashin in 2 weeks, J. Pat Burleson, Mr. George Minshew. We've asked Don DeBries. I even found Everett Man, Monster Man Eddie to be on the show, and also Colonel Phil Torres, who's retired, and the leader of the pistol shooting national championships, but also a great martial artist. Now, tonight we have someone very special when you think about Southern karate. And I'll tell you what, I mentioned these names, and I want you to know that he's not the name I'm going to mention right now, but he'll be the one we're interviewing. People in Southern karate, and if I miss a few, God bless you guys. I don't mean to, but the ones that come to my mind, and I'm just going on memories, Keith Vitale, Steve Vitale, Jerry Trimble, Ricky Smith, Randy Smith, Jerry Pennington, Bob Magan, Howard Herman, Joe Corley, Jeff Smith, Bill McDonald, Rick Souther, Sam Chapman, Gary Landreth, Jerry Rome, Larry Reinhart, Ron Sleeker, Steve Shepard, Ray Thompson, Charlie June, Bobby Tucker, Vic Coffin, Michael Dietrich, Michael Goldman, Hot Dog, Bruce Bucci, Mike Genova, Tommy Genova, John Ort, Jesse Bowen, Arthur Heller, Dave Adams, Victor Moore, Jerome Johnson, Gary Dillingham, Larry Dillingham, Helen Chung, John Chung, Jeff Gripper, Larry Brock, Ron Ferguson, just to name a few. Got to throw in Marty Knight in there, too. And we've lost a few people in Southern karate, Richard Jackson, Ronnie Barcoot, and probably the most famous man of all, Mr. Joe Louis. But tonight we have someone that's part of that group, and he's a incredible well, when I think of entrepreneur, I think of this man. And I'm talking about the one and only Mr. Danny McCall. We call him Big Dog, for the personal friends, but Danny McCall, are you here tonight, Danny?
I am, sir.
Hey, buddy, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Been very blessed.
Well, I'm so glad you could be on the show and answer my questions for also for my listeners and kind of talk about your history a little bit. You know, I mentioned those guys' name out of love and respect because every one of those guys I mentioned were part of that Southern movement in the 70s that changed martial arts or point karate, full contact and kickboxing around the country. The Southern attitude and the atmosphere and people like yourself who pioneered so many things, I'm really honored to be able to talk to you tonight. And for the people who don't really know Danny McCall, I kind of like to start at the beginning, Danny, and I like to talk about when you were young and before you maybe gotten karate, why did you decide to do it? Now, I know that you were also a Vietnam veteran. God bless you for your service. And maybe touch on that a little bit before you went to your engineering career, but you went to the service and you went to Vietnam. Tell me a little bit about that, brother.
Well, I was kind of a troubled teenager, just like some of the other people that got the martial arts, needed something to do. So I joined the military. After I dropped out of school, I had a car, a girlfriend, and a job. I didn't need anything else, did I? So,
no,
I, so I joined the military. I went to, they had a thing called Shake and Bake School where they were promoting 27 weeks of training. It was a non-commissioned officer school to get sergeants to go to Vietnam to handle the tanks and tracks over there. So I went through the training, went to Vietnam. I was there about 30 days when I got wounded. And I stayed in the hospital 3 or 4 weeks, and then they sent me back to the field. I spent my year there. I came back. I needed something to do. I had a lot of anger. I had a lot of mixed emotions about life in general. Got involved with karate. While I was in Vietnam, I met some mountain yards, which had some basic karate training that we exchanged ideas and things. But when I got back, I studied, because of the TV program, we're all tied to Kung Fu or Bruce Lee One, the older people, I would think. And so I wanted to get a dragon and a tiger on each arm. So I joined a Kung Fu school, believe it or not. I was one of my very first schools. I was, then I trained in Okinawan karate, but I got a black sash in Lee Kai Kung Fu.
Wait a minute. You're telling me that you got a black sash in Kung Fu? I just don't see you wearing panties, man. That's incredible.
Well, you know what? I kind of got liking those outfits. They were kind of slinky and stuff. But I studied Kung Fu with Joe Martin and had a great time with it. And it kind of kept me out of trouble. I was, you know, when I got back to Vietnam, I had numerous jobs, couldn't decide what I wanted to do. Try to go to school at night and work during the day, and that didn't work. So eventually I got a job with Duke Power the very first time, and I was studying Kung Fu, and then a guy came to town named Jerry Pennington, who was kind of shaking up everything. And he had a...
Well, I want to get to Jerry in a minute, but let's go back to the to Vietnam. Didn't you receive something very special from your service?
Yeah, well, you know, you get a Purple Heart when you get shot up over there. That's
okay.
That's part of your reward. I was, we were a track platoon, armor personnel, and I was lead track that day, and we got ambushed, and so that's kind of how I got wounded, and the rest is history from there. I won't go into a long war story,
sir.
But it was a trying event, and it takes. I'm not sure you ever get over combat and a situation like that. And when you come back from Vietnam and everybody hates you because they call you a baby killer, you know, you kind of have to learn to deal with that. And the martial arts kind of helped me work my way through that to give me a more positive attitude about what I was doing in life. It gave me an outlet to beat on that bag and get it out of my system.
Yes, sir. And again, I want to say from my listeners and from all the history generals and a lot of your friends and mine, thank you for your service. It means an awful lot. And God bless you on that. Now, let's go back to Jerry Pittenden. What an animal. What a animal. And he's been with you from the very beginning, right?
Well, yeah, I had other instructors, but he's the one that changed my life because he come in here with California, that little hippie walk he has and the long hair and attitude he has. And you know, he says, I went over there, I'll never forget, I went in there and he was sitting in the office. I said, hey, I want to do some of this fighting y'all do. I hear y'all get to hit. And he said, yes, sir, be here Tuesday night. So I came on Tuesday night, and for about 6 weeks I got beat up pretty regular. And so he said, you know what, if you'll come in the morning and remember now, during my whole fighting career, full contact, point, most of the first part of point fighting anyway, I was going to school under the VA program and working on an engineering degree. So he says, so I had free time. That's what I was getting at. You know, I scheduled my classes so that I could teach and work with him. He gave me a job. I quit my other job at Duke Power to teach karate. That went over really well.
Oh, okay.
You know, that one, I come home and told my wife, I said, hey, guess what? I'm going to be teaching karate full time. You quit the job? I said, yep, going to teach karate. I can't wait. And so that's what I started doing, teaching karate. And then he would train me. And he had a vision, like a lot of the people back then, that kind of wanted to see what karate was in a full contact version. So they came up with all these rules. And they decided that, you know, this kind of changed all the mindset for karate in general, because you had all these grandmasters, you know, 10th degree black belts that were getting in the ring, and these kickboxers were beating them to death, you know, because it was different. When you put gloves on your hands and feet, you're no longer a martial artist. You're a kickboxer. And that's what you have to learn, is you have to be able to separate the two. It's not a street situation. It's a sport. And so we were fortunate enough that Mr. Pennington had such a vision, him and Joe Quarley. Joe Quarley, of course, him and some of the guys created the PKA. Mr. Pennington and some of his people created the NKA, which is the National Karate Association of Full Contact Fighters. And he had his own stable. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that Mr. Pennington did create his own stable, and some of the incredible fighters that he trained was not just you, but he also trained some other people. Can you name some of those people?
Oh, absolutely. You know, he had quite a few that he used, but it was Jimmy Horsley, Ricky and Randy Smith. They called them the Gold Dust Twins, and Keith.
I remember them later, yes.
Yeah, Keith Hayflidge and myself. There were five of us on the Charlotte Warhawks, and we were.
Now, Keith Hayflidge, he had an incredible fight with Mr. Smith in North Carolina.
Yeah.
I remember being there for that fight. Is Mr. Hayflidge still here?
No, he passed away.
He passed away. He actually got
shot in a confrontation over his child. That was the story I was told. And
yes, sir.
He, you know, but anyway, Keith was quite an individual. I'll tell you one quick story about him. Mr. Pennington sent me to the airport to pick him up. I'll never forget it, man. I picked him up. He had one bag with him, and that was it, and the clothes on his back. And in that bag, he had his headgear, his gloves, his feet, and I thought, this guy don't want to do nothing but bang. And that's all Keith wanted to do. That was his whole function in life, was to get up and fight. And he inspired all of us. But and then we got, you know, Rick and Randy were bad to the bone for the lightweights they were. And, of course, Jimmy Horsley.
They were incredible as teenagers. I remember them bigly. Yes,
they were very talented. I mean, they got the job done. And so did Jimmy Horsley. Jimmy Horsley was a go-getter too, man. He got his share.
He learned his spin kit from a karate angel, I'll tell you that. I remember that spinning wheel kit.
Yep, he still is. I saw something on YouTube where he done a kata. I was like, holy cow, he remembers sun, I think, of sun and moon that we learned back in the day. But anyway, we had a good time. We had a good run there. It was a good living, teaching and doing all that, and I finally graduated. And
Well, out of all those guys, who was your toughest guy, the guy that you really wanted to go in and work out with and know that you're going to learn from him?
That was Keith Aplidge. Because Keith had been around a long time. And he had a lot of – he was like Joe Louis. He was very methodical, and he had a theory and a pattern to everything he did. And it was just – as an engineer, you know, you like that kind of feedback, you know, where you have something tangible that you can put down on paper, just like Joe Louis did. I mean, his manual, when he talks about how to fight a southpaw, how to do this, how – you know, most of us didn't know how to do that. You know, we just kind of,
yes,
okay, we learned some boxing and did our six kicks around, and we were going at it. But when he changed that into a theory of how to beat different people with different techniques, it changed the whole market in full contact karate.
Well, see, that's one that I want to ask you, too, is like you went through the transformation like a lot of us did from bare knuckle to wrapping our hands to going into the ring and fighting kickboxing. Or it was full contact first and then kickboxing.
Right.
When did you realize that you were made for that type of fighting, the full contact?
When I realized I could take a lot of punches.
Okay.
I was fortunate to be able to take some. I never got knocked down or knocked out on in all our fights, but, you know, we had some battles, and everybody does. You know, there's nobody out there that stands alone. There's somebody that comes along sooner or later, you know, gives you a hard time. And it's the same way in any sport. You're a competitor, and you know what I'm talking about. When I talk about point karate, I beat them all, and I've been beat by all of them. You know, it's a different game when you get into point karate, but when full contact karate, when you get through, you know who won. And that's what's so good about it. But what a sport it was becoming until you know, mixed martial arts stepped in. I mean, and
yes,
even Chuck Norris has tried to bring it back. And it's tough to compete against, you know, the MMA.
Absolutely. You know, I know that you're a complete martial artist. I say that because I've known you for 40 years. Well, you know what, the listeners know, I haven't seen you since 1976. I haven't actually hugged you or looked into your eyes in 40 years. But with our journey, what we've done, we'll talk about that a little bit later, as if I see you every day. But you do some things that really makes you a complete martial artist. And one of those is walking on fire, walking on glass. And tell me about the arrow in the throat thing.
Well, you know, Gary, I guess what we need to talk about is mind, spirit, and body. You know, we teach in the martial arts. And we teach it and teach it and teach it, but nobody really tests each other for it. And so I guess in 2005, I decided that I wanted to go to California and get with Tali Buchan and learn how to be a firewalk instructor and actually firewalk. And really the firewalk is just a metaphor of fear, you know, how to overcome that fear. I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all to walk on hot coals or glass or stick an arrow in your throat and break. But what it does, it takes you over that threshold of fear. And the first time you do anything, it is fearful. And for me, the firewalk was quite an experience. I was out there for about 6 days. And this guy is, Todd Buchan is the real deal. He has quite a following when it comes to firewalking and the glass walking. To me, the glass walking was more fearful than the walking on the fire, because I thought, God, at 240 pounds, I'm going to have a problem walking on this glass.
The first thing that went to your mind when you took that first step, Danny? What was going
through
your mind?
What goes through your mind is what he tells you, pay attention. And that's what I use the glass for now, to teach people how to pay attention. If you put your foot down on the glass and it feels sharp or feels like it's going to penetrate, then move it around. Move it somewhere else. And it's the same way with the arrow to the throat. I call it my ants technique, automatic negative thoughts. Because I think in life, a lot of things we do, we automatically, you know, have an opinion of it that, you know, it's going to be bad. It's like flying. They tell you if you have a fear of flying, then just go fly, and you'll eventually get comfortable with it. And it's just like anything. It's just like walking on the fire. It's just a belief. You know, I always say a belief takes four legs, and so, you know, you have to build yourself into it. Keeps you from making excuses You know what? When you can walk on fire, in my mind, you can just about, you make a decision. You can make a decision. You know?
Yes, sir. Well, that's pretty cool. Now, I know that you walk on fire, you step on glass and walk on it. I got one more thing to talk about, and that's the error in the throat. I just don't see myself, no matter how crazy people say Gary Lee is, putting an error to my throat and have someone push it that breaks. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I think the first time you do it, it is interesting. You know, you put it up against the wall and you put it the sharp end in your throat. You kind of keep moving forward until it starts spinning and breaking. But there's a point there. There's a threshold there that you think, well, did I get an arrow? Did I get an arrow that's, you know, stronger than the rest of them, a steel one or something? Because they use wooden arrows. That's not going to break and I'm going to impale myself. I haven't seen anybody get impaled yet, but I'm not saying it won't happen. But it is, it's quite a thought. And like I said, as soon as you do that, you automatically have the negative thoughts that you're going to get hurt. And that's what you have to overcome. And, you know, we're in life, everything we do nowadays, there's such fears of losing a job, fear of, you know, not having any money, fear of not having a job. And you need to be able to come to those. I like Joyce Meyer. She says that fears, how does that go? I'll think of it in a second. Fear is a down payment on a problem you may never have. And that's what I like because it may never happen.
Well, it's pretty impressive, and I admire you for that very deeply. Now, we've talked about the fighting a little bit, and we've talked about some of the people you've competed against, and we've talked about your spiritual sense as far as some of the things you do to be Danny McCall. But one thing about you that really, really is one of my favorite things in the whole world is that we have something very much in common that most people don't have in common. Is that we're both, I was a semi-professional bass fisherman. You're a professional one.
No, I was never a professional fisherman.
Oh, you were? Okay.
No, I want to be, but I never was. I
wanted to be too.
Hey,
well,
listen,
you know,
that's what keeps sales up. Let's keep them thinking they're
yes,
going to all be professionals.
Well, in 1987, you know, Forrest Wood changed my life, put me on a memo program, and, you know, winning the state championship in fishing was life-changing for me. But you also do something besides semi-professionally fish, and that is you own the largest Ranger boat dealership on the East Coast. How'd that come about? And what's the deal with that? Tell me about that.
Well, I don't know if you'd call it the largest, but we've definitely been in the top 10 for the last –
Absolutely.
Forever. But anyway, it come about as I was an engineer. I finally got that nuclear degree and became an engineer for Duke Power, our local thing. I started up McGuire. And so there was just things that didn't go well, you know, when you work for a big corporation, you're just a number in the lot. So one day I just had enough, and I can tell you when it was. That song that was out, I'll never forget, it said, "The future's so bright, I got to wear my sunglasses." That's when I quit my job. That's when I quit my job and started a boat business 30 years ago. I come home, told my wife, I said, "I quit my job. I'm going to start a boat business." She says, "What do you know about boats?" I said, "Not a whole lot, but I got a lot of enthusiasm." So that was 30 years ago, and I've been very blessed to have some good people that work for me over the years.
You started a little garage shack or something? I mean, with
like
a garage?
Yes.
A little
one building, and went from there to three. And you know, what I've done too, Gary, is, you know, I'm not getting any younger, so I'm downsizing so that I don't have to work all the time. I can get more of that fishing in and more time at grade school. So,
now, you're a tournament promoter now, right? You promote tournaments?
That's correct.
Fishing tournaments?
This Saturday I've got one with the an organization that we're giving away a Ranger boat, motor, and trailer.
Wow.
It's going to be big. We'll have a good time Saturday. And it's for a good cause. It's for the Special Olympics out of Shelby, North Carolina. And so I chose them as a charity this year to make a boat, motor, and trailer donation. And Ranger, of course, is one of the major sponsors. And so is Evinrude. They're both big players in my life. They've both been extremely good to me as far as product and support and everything. You know, I know everybody likes Mercury's and Yamaha's, but I've just been an Evinrude person, you know. You know what? People get branded like that. I grew up with my granddad, and that's what he had was a Johnson on the back of his bass boat. So I thought everybody.
Yeah, I remember him. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a long time ago. Hey, I want to do a shout out to a couple guys like us who fish for. Well, they fish for a living. Either they guide or Alan actually hits the circuit. And that's Alan Kelly. Hello, buddy, if you're listening. This is Don Willis, my buddy from Ohio. By the way, lives in Florida now. And I believe he sponsored Don, don't you? Yeah, Don's one of your sponsors, and also Mr. Steve Parks, the man who invented Rage Tail. Hello, guys, if you're listening, we love you, and we're far and few being bass fishermen and black belts and karate. Now, you know, Danny, one more thing about the bass fishing. You know, I know you travel all around the country, and you represent Ranger and what you do, but you're in touch with some pretty impressive people. Johnny Morris, Ranger, I mean, Forrest Wood. How has that fishing influenced you in your overall perspective of running a business in karate and fishing?
Well, you know, running a business, I guess the first thing you need to learn when you run a business, I'm not in the boat business. I'm not in the motor business. I'm in the people business. And that once you learn that, it's just like karate. We're in the people business. We change lives. There's no question about it. And
now you have a full time school too, right?
Yeah, I do. I teach Tuesday and Thursday nights. Have for the last 40 years. Don't know what I'd do if I didn't do that. The nights that I don't go, like if I go to the beach or something, I feel like I've lost a child or something because I don't go teach or hang out at the karate school. It's really just a lifestyle. I think one of the things that I told you before is I think lifers, karate lifers like myself, are mostly loners. You know, we love what we do, but we like our time, and we enjoy our time. And I think that I speak for a lot of martial artists when it comes to that because we give so much of ourselves to the kids, hoping that we can make them better and help them improve themselves in life because we've already walked that path. That's why I always say I walk alone because that's where you are, really. I mean, your parents can help you just so far, and that's one of the reasons I support karate. And what you do is awesome, keeping that museum going. I mean, these kids are to come up just like your son, steps into that ring, and he's alone. You can't help him. You can't tell him what to do because he's at that point that he knows what he's going to do.
You get him so far, and then you kind of let him go. And as we're speaking, Jarrett's in Dublin, Ireland, with Richard Plowden fighting on the USA team. He's going to be fighting in Ireland here tomorrow morning at 12 o'clock. So I'm very, very proud of him and what he's done. And by the way, let's talk about your son a minute. You have an impressive son. He's involved with another sport, which is known as NASCAR. Tell me about Matt a little bit.
Well, Matt didn't have a choice about karate from the time he could stand. From the time I like yours, you can't tell me you didn't do this. From the time he could stand up, we lived on the lake at that time, and I'd take him down to the water, and he was probably two or three, and I'd get him up knee deep, and I'd make him pick his leg up, do a sidekick, pick it up, do a sidekick, and so he didn't have a choice. So he studied karate, and then we got into go karting, and then go karting led to cars, and cars led to him wanting to drop out of college just to race. And I said, nope, you're going to finish that, get that out of the way, and you do whatever you want. So he became an engineer. And, of course, you know, we just didn't have the funds to make the transition into Cup or Nationwide or Bush, whatever they want to call it, the next level down. So
close when I did with Garrett. I gave his my wife, Tammy, shurikens to swallow, and I put nunchucks in his pillow. And, you know, of course, I put Ninja Turtle movies on every time I could get on TV. And, we influence our kids really deeply with what we'd like them to be, but mostly we want them to be happy. And Matt is a fast NASCAR driver. I'm sure he's happy, and I know he's good at it. I've followed him for the past few years.
He's
pretty good at it. What did he want?
He's a crew chief now. He's a crew chief now.
Okay.
Yeah, he's a crew chief for Jamie McMurray on the cup level. You know, the Sprint Cup level as high as you can get. Yep. And they did very well last year. They made the chase last year. They made the chase this year. So he's having a lot of success in what he does. And I think part of his success comes from all the experience of driving and his discipline. He still trains. I wish he would teach the pit crew and all the guys around there karate, but they do some other exercises. They train every day, and he kind of does that for himself. He comes to the dojo and works out with us from time to time. But, yeah, he's got a great job, and now he has a son. So it won't be long, Gary. I'll have another little one to teach karate to.
Wow.
And go
cool, brother.
Again, you know. Yeah.
Well, you know, Dan, that's pretty amazing. I mean, it really is. NASCAR, bass fishing, and martial arts. What a threesome. That's pretty cool.
Hey, don't forget my daughter. Let me brag on my daughter a little bit. She's living down in Myrtle Beach. Yeah, she lives at Myrtle Beach, and she does Stunning and Brilliant. She's a wedding planner, and she has a license to steal from us daddies when it comes to doing a wedding, because you don't want to cut the corners. You know, you got to spend all you can to get that wedding out of the way. But yeah, she's very successful down there, and that's why I have myself listed as living there, because mentally I am, but physically I'm still in Denver and doing what I love. I do karate a couple nights a week, and maybe on Saturday mornings with the class. And like you say, I'm on the water once or twice every week, and it is a joy to be in the disposable income business. I mean, that's what folks are.
You know,
you got to do it. Yep.
Before I get into this next part, I got to ask you, because, you know, I just wonder, you know, your trademark, ever since I remember Danny McCall, was that, you know, incredible punch, because I felt that a few times. But that Fu Manchu, you wore a Fu Manchu ever since I've known you, since the 70s. And you still got
right.
it. How long have you had that? Ever since I've known you? 40 years?
Yeah, ever since you've known him. But I kind of let my Fu Manchu grow out a couple years. But I started shaving it out of the middle. So, you know, you can't get away from it. You know what I mean?
It's definitely your trademark, little brother, without a doubt. And you know, what I'm going to do now is this part of the show, I've created something just for you guys, just for the Legends and Pioneers. It's called the Legends Name Game. And I'm going to say a name to you, and then, you know, give me a sentence or a light paragraph on what do you think about that person, how that person has influenced you or sport karate or Southern karate. Are you ready?
I'll try it.
Okay, well, here we go. Cam Chapman.
Sam Chapman was a great fighter himself, but what was so unique about him is he had a stable of fighters that he trained down there. And Gary, the thought process in North Carolina was, it's us against him. So, or his fighters. So that's the kind of reputation he had.
Wow. Yeah, plus he was a fighter too. So you had
he was a great fighter.
Absolutely. Absolutely. How about his stablemate that he raised, Bobby Tucker?
He's about as quick as they get, don't you think?
I think he was the fastest man on the planet. Yeah, actually the first recipient of the Joe Louis TKA Award, I believe. And everybody I've always interviewed said that Bobby had the fastest legs in the business.
I'm going to tell you, man, he could cross the line. There is no question. When he come across the line, he was there.
How about Mike Genova, the poodle?
Mike Genova was a technician, a great fighter. He's a great person, too. I mean, he's not just a good fighter. He's a great person. He coached me in a couple fights in the point world. You know, we see things that other people can't see. He saw things in some of the fighters I was fighting. He helped me some. And I have a lot of respect for him. He's done a lot for karate and probably will continue to do it. He's like me. He loves it.
He's a lifer. like you said. Now,
absolutely.
I'm going to say the same. You might have to think back a little bit. But I put them out just for you, brother, because I know you go back to the 70s. How about John Ork?
John was a good – he was part of that group. You know what I mean? He was part of that Sam Chapman era down there, the Sika. Like I said, it was us against them, but Ork was a – he was scrappy, man. He come to do business, and he could get it done. I have a lot of respect for him. John, I hadn't seen him for a while. Actually, like you say, we haven't met each other, seen each other in 40 years, but Facebook changed everything when it comes to that. And
yeah.
Just to see these guys is just brings back a lot of memories. But, yeah, he was a good fighter.
Okay, I got a couple more for you. I'm going to go from fighting to kata. I got John Chung.
Well, they don't get any better than kata. I mean, that man ruled in that. He just give you cold chills to watch him do kata. You think, how does he do that? You know, I never did watch him fight that much because we were always competing. You know, back then.
Oh, he was a fighter. I remember in the 70s he fought. Yeah.
I'm not saying he wasn't a fighter. I just never got to see him fight too much except in the grand championship rounds. But, yeah, he was good.
How about Mike's little brother? Remember Tommy? Tommy Genova?
Yeah, I saw him fight a few times. He was.
Now, you guys have something in common. You two guys have something in common. Same with the last guy. I mentioned Ray Thompson to you in the pre-interview. And you and Tommy and Ray Thompson had something in common. You guys were just mean.
Yeah. Well, I know Ray was. I can tell you that right now, Ray.
Tell about Ray Thompson, people who don't know who Ray Thompson is. By the way, he's the father
Ray.
Of Wonder Boy Thompson, Steve Thompson. Yeah,
oh, okay.
The fighter, the MMA fighter. But tell me about Ray Thompson.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that a while back that Ray had his son fighting in the MMA. But, you know, if he's as mean as Ray was, he'll be fine.
Now, when you mean mean, what do you mean by mean? I mean, for the listeners who don't understand what point karate mean was.
Here's what mean means. I don't really care about the points. I just want to see how hard I can hit you.
Okay. Okay, that's a good answer. That's the way it was, absolutely.
That's the way it was.
I got one more name for you, brother, and someone that tests all of our lives, and we miss him every day, but he's from your backyard, Mr. Joe Lewis.
Hey, what can you... I just told you, man, the most methodical, not just a great fighter, well, probably the greatest. I mean, that's what we say. But what I liked about Joe is, you know, I got to know him pretty good through Mr. Pennington and Ricky and Randy. They had quite a closeness with him. But we shared time together, and he was, like I said, he was just so – he had a theory or a technique for the technique. It was just – and, you know, you can go back and read anything he wrote, and it's solid. I mean, it applies to everything that we do in fighting. All you got to do is just apply it. You know, believe. Just like this firewalking, it helps you with your belief. So believe his techniques will work, and they will.
Right. Well, you know, thank you for playing the Legends name game. And I think that, no, I know that a lot of the listeners understand it. You've known a lot of people, and a lot of people have touched your lives. And that's a fun thing to do, to talk about the history of individuals. You know, one of the things is that you've been with me from the very beginning, even though we haven't seen each other in 40 years, of being part of the Sport Karate Museum archives and a history general. And I remember when I put Mr. Pitty in too, I wanted you also because, you know, I know your history. I know what you did. And let me tell you a real fast story about Mr. Pennington, and maybe you can beat it with another story, but I got to tell this story. I'm at Bob Walls Roast in Hollywood, and everybody's there, and I'm a nervous wreck. And Mr. Pennington saw that, you know. I mean, he's been my friend since the 70s, and he could tell I was very nervous. And he grabbed me, and he pulled me behind the curtains, and he literally sat me down on the steps. And he had his old ragged gi and his old ragged black belt. And he had it wrapped up traditionally. You know how that is. And he says, Gary, what you're doing is pretty amazing, putting all these people together. And I want to do something. I want you to remember this moment. And he handed me that belt, and he handed me that uniform. And he said, this maybe will calm your nerves a little bit. And it did, but what he did next really caught my nerves. He reached inside his pocket, and he brought out a flask. And he opened it up, and he said, I want you to take a hit of this. Of course, I had no idea what it was. I had heard of it. He put moonshine and stuff. I didn't know what it was. But it was a shot of bourbon. And every time I see him now, when he comes to one of my events, I always buy him a quart of Jack Daniels, just for that memory. And, you know, Monty Pettit is a character, but he's the one of the first guys to give me a belt and signed uniform for the Sport Karate Museum archives. And so my question is, Danny, what's it like being chosen to be a history general and to keep that history alive for the generations, for your grandkids, for the kids that are growing up, learning about what sport karate did for America? What's it like being a history general?
It's an honor to start with. And second of all, you know, what you do is so incredible, getting all these people together, getting us all together and talking about us. And, you know, we're learning things about each other that we didn't know. You know, we went to the tournaments and got in a ring and done our deal and got our trophy, our money, and left. And so we didn't really have a big relationship other than bigger tournaments. Like Joe Corley, he pulled us all together. I mean, everybody lived for South Atlanta. I mean, if you didn't go to the Battle of Atlanta, you were not a point fighter or a full contact fighter. So Joe has been instrumental in my life, along with Jerry Rome and some of the other ones. Ross Scott, you know, I actually went and trained with him for 3 weeks prior to his fight with Jerry Rome, which he won, even though he got knocked down the first round. But being a history general and just being able to be associated with some of these people is incredible, especially when you see where the arts come from and where it's going and how it's changing. But you know what? It's still the same. I mean, when it comes down to the basic character training, I mean, that's what it's all about, you know. Our fighting skills are one thing that we develop, but it's just the fact of being to associate ourselves with people that make us better. And I think that's what it's about, is being able to make yourself better every day.
Well,
you know,
let me share with the listeners, one of the reasons why you're a history general, you mentioned someone earlier, you actually spent weeks or training with him, Mr. Ross Scott, who went on to fight Jerry Rome for the heavyweight championship, and you actually spent some time with him in the ring, right?
Oh, yeah. I was his sparring partner for 3 weeks. That's one thing about Mr. Pennington. We were one of our full contact team was well-funded. I don't know how he did it. He put on events and stuff to raise money, of course, but we didn't pay for anything. We had paid sparring partners. He paid people to come in there and fight us and train us and work with us. And when he sent me out to Glenn Keeney, that's who I stayed with when I was there. It was not Glenn Keeney. What's the other one? It was Ross's instructor.
Parker Shelton.
Parker Shelton, thank you. Yeah, Parker Shelton. What a man. What a man. He picked me up at the airport.
The president of the Dragon Image Fighting Award was Mr. Parker Shelton. Yes.
Yep. Well, he deserved it because he could get the job done too. But Parker, he helped me a lot when I was out there, and I trained with Ross Scott every day for 3 weeks. Mr. Bennett sent me out there, and I think that helped me a lot in my training because Ross was a no BS kind of fighter. He was an Okinawan trained individual. He came from those roots, and you know, first meeting him at the USK Nationals and stuff. He really is. He was a badass. There ain't no question. He could hit.
Well, speaking of Mr. Shelton, you know, we lost him a few years back, and but he was actually the first president of the United States Karate Association under Robert Trias. And I got to ask you, when you worked out with Mr. Shelton, it was probably more judo than karate, huh? Or was it a mixture of both?
Well, yeah, I didn't realize that. I asked him one day. I said, "Hey, Parker, do you do any of this kicking and punching?" He said, "You want to do something?" I said, "Yeah." So we geared up. I get in the ring, and all I'm trying to do is get up. That guy would sweep me, throw me. I said, "This ain't full contact karate." He said, "Well, then hit me." So you know, he was really good at judo. I mean, he was. And not only that, but he was a good individual. And
Yes, he was.
I miss him. He left us a lot sooner than he should have. But
yes.
he had it going on between him and Ross. They had a world of getting it done out there in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Well, amazing individuals that you've come across. Now, going back to some of my last questions, why is it important that we keep the sport karate history alive to our younger generation? I mean, come on, there's MMA, there's Olympic Taekwondo, which, by the way, we'll get to see that in the Olympics in 2020. We'll talk about that in a moment. But why is it so important to keep the sport karate history alive to this younger generation?
Well, the younger generation has kind of watered it down a little bit, as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to the point tournaments. Some of them are having continuous sparring, but it's still a very controlled situation. When me and you were kicking and punching, you knew who won when it was over. You didn't have to look
yep.
at the scoreboard, you know. And I think when they look back on these people that have carried this forward, it's important to know where these guys came from. There's a history, and you're doing a great job of where they came from, you know, and what they did to get there. You know, nobody knew that, you know, I dropped out of high school and ended up in the Army in Vietnam and had all kind of anger issues and got involved in karate just so I could kind of stay on the path so I didn't kill somebody and try to turn that energy into something positive. And I think I've done that over the years. And I think
yes, you
what
have.
You're doing the same way, you know. And I'm not the
well,
only
you're
one.
You're an inspiration to a lot of people, Danny.
You know, there are a lot of great instructors out there, the older boys that have paid the price, you know.
You know, I want to ask you a question leading up to my important question. But if I ask you, Danny, if you had the power to change something right now, 2016, that was happening maybe in 1970 or 80, what would you change?
You mean what's changed in today? What would I change in today's world?
Yeah, what would you change to make it better, do you think, to compare it? Well, I mean, there's some ideas that you had. You talked to me about having some new ideas. What would those be?
Well, I think one thing we need to do is we need to come up with an electronic system for point karate so that we don't have that human factor in there. And I want to say that, you know, and no disrespect to any black belts or anybody, but when you've judged all day, you start getting a little lax and start looking around, and maybe you didn't see the point, so you raise your hand because somebody else did. And this would eliminate that human factor. And I think that we'll eventually get there, have an electronic
scoring. Now, you're talking about putting sensors on the fighter?
Okay. Both of you will be wearing sensors in the target area, and they use it in fencing. You know, that's where I kind of it's not a you know, man's not had an original thought. That's what I saw, and I thought, well, why can't we do that? And I've heard that some of the people are trying to do it or implementing it, but I haven't really seen it on a. And it should be relatively cheap to do with our wireless stuff we have nowadays. I mean, it should be able to be fit in those gloves and make it more realistic.
Have you ever heard of Kim Kirby? That's Ray McCallum's student. Kim Kirby?
Yeah.
Kim Kirby back in the early 90s, I believe, he created something that was really cool. He actually put sensors on the fighters where when the judges clicked the click, the automatically score would go on the board, you know, 2 points or 1 point, and it was way ahead of the time of Juventus and these other scoreboards that they do now, where when the judge saw a point, he'd do the click, and the point would come up on the scoreboard. Now, remember, back then, the spectators were in the dark. They had nothing to look at. They had nothing to see.
Right.
Nothing controlled.
Yeah.
And even though back then it was an idea, today, with today's technology, like you said, it might could happen. It might happen tomorrow if someone comes up with the right equipment where it's sold to the groups, NASCA and NBL and stuff. So maybe that will be in the future.
Speaking of the future,
Danny.
Yeah, it's got to be.
Go ahead.
It's got to be.
Well,
it's got to be the future.
Speaking of the future, Go ahead, buddy. I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Now, we can't apologize to each other. We're not fishing with each other.
That's right. Well, stay in the back of the boat. You stay in the back of the boat. I'll tell you when we're done.
I don't want to be in the back of the boat, man. I want to drive. I knew where the trees are at.
That's right.
Hey, look at our lifetime. I'm 62. I'll go ahead and share it. I don't know how old you are. I know you're pretty close.
Yep.
In our lifetime, we're going to get to see Karate-Do, what we love to do, real Karate-Do, be accepted as a demonstration sport in the Karate Olympics in 2020 in Tokyo. I mean, all these years we've had this Taekwondo trembling shock, not really fighting, no kata, but now we get to see kata. I think the general public is going to be mesmerized by kata, but how do you feel about that? The Karate-Do, what we love and know, will be allowed to be in the Olympics. How much is that going to change things?
Well, in my opinion, it should have already been there. I know there's just politics involved and everything. Here's how big it is. It'll change all of our karate schools. It'll change the way we teach. It'll change the way we do everything other than the character. Our character training will never change. Just preparing people for the Olympics. Just think. The kids I have now that are 13, 14 years old, in 4 years, they'll be 18, 19. They'll be perfect age to be in the Olympics. And I hope that me and you are judges there, that we get to be chosen to be part of such a fabulous thing that's going to change karate, because it's going to cause people to get involved. Of course, there'll be special people that, you know, have the inside to it, that can create their own schools to get them all, but we'll get our share of them. And listen, you know, hard work will always beat talent. And so if you've got some people that are trained hard, they'll get their share. The Olympics, that's going to be huge. It's going to be huge when we see karate.
What's exciting is that, you know, being a kid advocate like you are and like I've done with my life through Six Flags and Kids Expo and stuff, my attitude is real simple. If we can get a kid that's fired up about learning real Karate-Do, learning the traditional katas that probably will be mandatory to do, and just having that overall real true fighting spirit and having worked toward a goal to be in the Olympics, to be an Olympian, I'm just overwhelmed at it. And I'm excited about it. I really am. I'm excited for all the kids that are growing up to be able to be a part of it. And I just want it to prosper. I don't want to be a demonstration sport. I want to be something that everyone looks forward to every 4 years. Absolutely.
Well, it gives them another goal. Like I like that term there, of a goal, because once you get them to black belt and you start training them, you know, when they get black belt, they're just beginning to learn, really, in my mind. But this now gives them a second goal of going to the Olympics as a black belt or whatever rank they happen to be at that time. But it gives them another goal. You know, whether it be tournament fighting or kata or weapons. And that's one of the things, you know, as in our system, in our ACNA system, we teach everything. You know, we even have grappling. But the karate, it's just another tool. That's what I tell everybody. You know, what do you think of this or that or Krav Maga? Here's what I think about all these arts. They're just another tool to protect yourself. And, you know, that's what it all boils down to.
Well, I know you teach American freestyle. That basically means that you take the best of the systems that you've been encountered with, from Kung Fu, Okinawan Karate, what Mr. Pinnington taught you, and you form it into a system that you can pass on and taking the best. That's really the American way, isn't it? Taking the best of something and making it your own?
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And I told you that I was watching the Olympics and the late 70s, and they said they were doing, they were swimming. They said, what are they doing? They said, well, they're going to do the freestyle. Well, what's the freestyle? Oh, that's where they can do anything they want to do to get one of that swimming pool to the other. And in my mind, I thought, that's what I want to do in the martial art. Whatever it takes to win, to get across there and protect myself, the best of the best, because every system has really something great to give. If you can just pick what you want, and put it into a system that you feel like, and it's all opinionated, we know that, of what you think will work in a real life situation, then we go from there. And you want to work on the basics, you know. There's no way of getting away from the basics. Once you learn the basics in karate, you pretty well have gotten most of it down. You work on Joe's theories. It's exciting. And I guess that's why me and you and the rest of us stay in the art, because we're never going to learn it all. You're never going to learn it all. And that's what's, as an educator. Yeah, there's always something new. You know, I always say that poultry is just another word for chicken, but everybody's got a different way to do a lot of things, but it all boils down to the same thing, you know.
Well, you know, I'm going to open up the phone to any caller that wants to talk to you in a few moments. And if you do, you can just call 657-383-1410 and be a little patient. We'll have you on the line there in a minute. But I want to ask you a two-part question, Big Dog, Danny McCall.
Sure.
It's a two-part question. So the first part is, if someone walked into your dojo, never trained in martial arts before, and just had heard that you teach martial arts, what's your best soft sell approach to get that person to train with you?
I bring them in and ask them a few questions, you know, ask them why they chose to, why they think they want to learn the art. And if they go, well, I want to beat up my brother or my sister because they took my candy or something, you know, something to that effect, or somebody offended them or something, and they just want to beat somebody up, then I try to give them free lessons until I can change their attitude, because like I told you at the beginning, as an instructor, that's our job, is to re-educate them of how to redirect that energy into something positive instead of just going back and you teach them some punches and kicks. I've had ladies that have come and taken class until they got their green belt or so, and you never see them again, and said, oh, well, that's as far as I need to go. My husband never hit me again. So, you know, everybody has a different goal when they come to class.
Yes, sir. Well,
that's what I would.
It's a smart question. And the second part is, I walk in, and the first thing I say is, hey, who's the instructor here? I'm a ninth degree. Wait a minute, I just got promoted to 10th degree black belt because I just belong to my fifth Hall of Fame, and I want to know who the instructor is here, and I want to fight him. Does he want to have enough guts to get on the floor with me? The guy walks on the floor without taking his shoes off. He's looking around for the instructor. How would you approach someone like that walking into your dojo?
I tell him to go ahead and shut the door, and do we need to put gear on or not? That's the way I would approach it.
Would the old Danny McCall come out?
The old Danny McCall will come out. Hey, let me share one with you with Mr. Pennington. So,
okay.
I got to share this with you since you brought that up. So, we're playing football.
Okay.
A lot of people know what that is, but that's, you know, I'm on one side and the guy's on the other side. And Mr. Pennington comes over there. This guy's on the other side. We had a karate school beside this game room. So, we'd always go over there between classes and play pool or foosball. So, I'm playing with this guy and he's over there and he says, so you take karate with that guy? I said, yeah. So Mr. Penn walks over there. He said, do you take karate? He said, yep. I'm an eighth degree black belt. It couldn't have been more than maybe 20, 25. Mr. Penn reaches across the table and slaps him in the face. And the guy, he said, I'm ready for my butt whooping right now. And that guy ran out the back door. We ain't seen him since.
Well, I love my two-part questions. Hey, with that said, I'd like to open the lines again to 657-383-1410. Brother Jesse, are you on the line?
Hello, sir. How you doing? This is a great show.
Great. Thank you. Is anybody on the line to talk to Danny?
No, sir. Right now, all of our lines are clear. And, again, you're
well,
welcome
good.
To call like in.
That.
Again,
I
that call-in number.
Friend.
Is what six?
Let's go
five.
Plug the book one more time and talk about the book a little bit before I say goodnight to Danny. Tell me about the book a little bit more.
Wow, the book has been amazing. We're talking about Who's Who in the Martial Arts. The new Legends book has just come out. It is an updated book. I picked it up, a new copy of the new book the other day, and I couldn't put it down. and not because, you know, I'm the author of the book, it's because all of the martial artists and the history and the people that are in the book and reading their life stories of why they got involved in the martial arts, the things that they've accomplished in the martial arts. You know, it's really, Mr. Corley and I, Joe Corley, we were talking this morning, because I sent him a copy of the book on Saturday and the new book, and we were just talking about how amazing the book is and how my staff has really put this book together. You know, it's really amazing. And what we're doing, like I said, we had a book signing at my school, Bill. Superfoot Wallace came in. We did a seminar. We did book signing. So we raised, you know, about $400 or $500 that were given to the United Way from the book signing. So, you know, and this book is not about, it's not about just people wanting something. This is about people that have done things. And this is what our show is about. This show is really about, you know, talking about Danny, you know, talking about all the other guests we had on the show a couple of weeks ago, all the different things we're doing. We are in the education business, and the Who's Who's book is an educational book. You know, people are referring to it as a martial arts history book, and not only do we share the stories and the bios from the people of today, we're also, you know, people have already passed away. We're sharing, they're keeping their stories alive. So, you know, the book is great. Everything has been going, you know, really, really fantastic. Our alumni are setting up their book signing. So the book has been going great. And to get a copy of the book, again, we're running the same offer that we did last week on our show. We've been doing every week on the show, and that is that when you go to our website, which is www.whoswhointhemartialarts.com, and you order a book, we're going to donate $10 of the sale of that book to the United Way. So if you're in the process of, you know, really wanting to help people, and this is what we should be doing, is really reaching out to helping people that need help. We all need help at times, and what we're trying to do at my martial arts school and also with the book is be a part of that giving part that helps someone else to have a better life.
Well, you know, I spent a lot of time on the phone, email, doing the work I do for the Sport Quad Museum Archives, and someone mentioned me the other day, and it kind of makes sense that Mr. Owen and Mr. Corey, Mr. Smith, and this radio show is kind of like a tsunami coming across America, hitting people with the history and the icons and the dreams of what we did back in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And I want to thank you personally for what you've done and kind of rejuvenated that idea. And I promised my friends that I would mention this before I say goodbye to Danny. Two incredible events happened this weekend. One, Charlie Lee hosted a June reunion with over 100 people coming and surprising Master Ree at Charlie Lee's house. People like Mr. Smith, Michael Coles, Stephen Oliver, Helen Chung, John Chung, Michael Dietz. There's a whole slew of people to honor Master June Ree. And for people who don't know who Master June Ree is, of course, he's the innovator. He created the June Ree equipment. He literally created musical kata, trained hundreds of champions, was responsible for being called the father of Taekwondo in America. The other person I want to put a shout-out to that had an incredible event this weekend in Los Gatos, California, his name is Andrew Finelli, and he put together a group of individuals that have never been together before ever in the history of martial arts. Mike Stone, Jumil Jamuro, Bill Wallace, Alan Goldberg, Harry Mock, Peter Morales. I mean, just it goes on and on and on. And his incredible All-Pro Taekwondo Hall of Fame honored these legends. If we keep doing this, Mr. O'Bowen, and we keep getting people fired up by honoring these icons and legends, we're going to be educating. We're going to be having fun doing it. And it'd be very innovative to see where people take our sport in the next 10 years. And I want to say a thank you to all those people who really care about the pioneers and icons and the people that we talked about tonight. Danny, I can't thank you enough for being on the show. We're going into a little bit overtime, but you're well worth it. I just want you to know how much you mean to me personally, and what you mean to sport karate. And the time you shared with us tonight, I'm sure that it touched a lot of people. And anything to close out and say to the listeners?
Yeah, I'd like to tell Jesse that was a great statement about us being educators. And that's one thing Jesse is. He is an educator in a lot of facts. I mean, me and him have a lot of things in common when it comes to extreme spirituality, as you want to say it. But this is unbelievable what he's doing with this. And you yourself with the sport, I appreciate you allowing me to be part of it and tell part of my history. It'll mean a lot to some of my students and everybody. A lot of people never knew I was in Vietnam. You know, you don't talk about things like that. At least I did. And I do appreciate the opportunity to tell my story.
Thank you, Danny. And I can say this. I love you. I always have. Even though you
Thank
did
you,
it,
sir.
You know, I love you.
Yes,
and,
sir.
And with that said, we have another show coming up on the 15th. It's the one only Jamie Cashin and from Fort Worth, Texas, who takes care of Mr. J. Pat Burleson. And if we're lucky, Jamie might have Mr. Burleson with him, the very first national karate champion of America. With that said, on behalf of the AMMA, thank you for listening for another segment of America's Pioneers and Legends on the radio network. God bless everybody. Aloha.